case number 07-5264. Theodore R. Lucas, appellant versus Margaret Spellings, in her official capacity as Secretary, U.S. Department of Education, her agents and successors. Mr. Carl for the appellant, Ms. Momini for the appellee.
Good morning, Your Honors. This case on appeal is an imposition of sanctions under Rule 11B. We found that there's no precedent for the award of Rule 11 sanctions for successfully opposing a motion for summary judgment. And we found no case that supports a finding of a violation of Rule 11 under the facts and circumstances presented here. The cases and the treatises suggest that the pleading as a whole should be considered, and that Rule 11B does not provide for sanctions for arguments based on inferences or tendentious characterizations or even failing to distinguish between facts and inferences. We submit that under the treatises, counsel are permitted to argue the facts, and they're not required to state in every paragraph that an inference may be drawn from the counsel's characterization of the arguments or the facts. And we'd advocate that this court adopt the approach taken by then Circuit Judge Breyer in a case called Navarro-Ayala, cited in our briefs, that says that Rule 11 does not penalize overstatement or authorize an overly literal reading of each factual statement, and that the individual sentences should not be considered separately or taken out of context, and that Rule 11 does not impose or require a standard of perfection. And certainly under this, we'd submit under the standard in Navarro-Ayala that there is no basis for imposing the sanctions in this case. Certainly, there was no advance notice of the existence of the legal standards set forth in Curl or in Greenberg, the cases on which the magistrate relied. If you look at the number of cases that have cited either Curl or Greenberg, they certainly do not, we submit, represent compelling authority for the proposition that inferences have to be clearly identified as inferences. If you look at the Curl case, for example, there was a false representation that was at the heart of the appeal, and the entire appeal was baseless. Curl, in turn, it turns on the Greenberg case, and the Greenberg case is rarely cited even by the court that issued it, or the Kelly case. The Kelly case was about a false affidavit that was submitted that was at the heart of the very case. And even in Kelly, the court said, well, we didn't think, we don't believe any sort of formal sanctions are appropriate.
In some of the instances here, it seems that you were relying on points made in the plaintiff's affidavit, and that those points might have been seemed a stretch, but they were evidence. They were in the plaintiff's affidavit, and you were relying on them. How do we deal with something like that?
Well, the whole purpose of summary judgment is to smoke out the evidence as to whether or not there's really a dispute of material fact there, and the defendant has their view of the evidence, and in this case, that there were no disputes of material fact, and the plaintiff has a different view of the evidence, and we tried to present an argument as to why the entry of summary judgment was not appropriate. But if you look at the whole summary judgment exercise in context, the plaintiff was sanctioned for filing a winning opposition to a motion that was premised on the assertion, on the representation that there were in fact no disputes of material fact.
And that was the theory of the case. Just I want to make sure I understand this, because this is important to put in context for me at least. The theory of the case was that the plaintiff had worked there and understood that this process, at least according to plaintiff, could be cooked up essentially. The KSAs could be watered down. The person was pre-selected. The qualifications would be specified to meet the person they wanted. Interview questions would be given ahead of time. Right? Is that the theory?
Yes,
that's the theory of the case. And the plaintiff in the affidavit suggested that he had firsthand knowledge of that practice having occurred in the past, right?
Yes, Your Honor. And, you know, there was a, you know, if you look at the size of the appendix, there was a huge record in front of the court. There was no effort to hide the ball or to misrepresent what or make representations about something that was not in the record. But, you know, our in the summary judgment practice, we conceived of it as having a duty of advocacy to make an argument to the court that there were, in fact, disputes of material fact and that, therefore, the, you know, the entry of summary judgment was not, you know, was not appropriate. And one of the broader policy concerns is that this sort of entry of summary judgment could have a broad a chilling effect. And the next policy question is, where does it lead? Well, in this case, sanctions were imposed on as a result of successful opposition to summary judgment. And, you know, the next time the sanctions could be imposed upon the party asserting that there were, in fact, no, you know, no disputes of material fact. And the fact is that sua sponte sanctions are done so rarely that this court should really pay close attention to what was done in the district court. If it, you know, if you're into a baseball analogy, it's like a pitcher calling his own strikes and balls. And you know, he's not, the magistrate judge we submit is not in a position to make any sort of assessment as to whether or not you know, there's been a violation here in the absence of number one, a motion for sanctions, and of course, you know, when the sanctions are imposed,
rules contemplate.
Beg your pardon?
The rules contemplate a sua sponte allegation.
Yes, they do. But the reason why the court we would ask would take a really close look at it is because yes, you can have sua sponte sanctions. But that brings us to the question of what should the standard be.
Well, we can hardly say that he's in no position to judge when the rules set him up as the judge.
That's right, Your Honor. But the real issue is whether or not there should be a requirement that the standard should be akin to contempt. And the second issue is whether or not this court ought to take a close look at at the use of the
sanctions. He's in no position to fairly judge is what you're saying.
Yes, I think that's the distinction I should have made, Your Honor.
That doesn't take it out of the rules.
No, it doesn't, but in view of the fact that there is no safe harbor provision and in view of the fact that there's no precedent for the imposition of rule.
When you responded to these charges, you did back away from one or two, I think, didn't you? One or two of the statements.
Yes, Your Honor.
I mean, in the same way that you would have done if you could have withdrawn it altogether.
Yes, Your Honor. But
as to the others, you didn't. So even if you'd had the opportunity to withdraw them, I'm not sure why it was a missed opportunity here.
I think if we'd had the opportunity to withdraw it, you know, we would have withdrawn the pleading and rewritten the whole thing.
You're not.
Yeah, but it wasn't a perfect pleading.
Well, as to some of the allegations, though, you said, well, you're right, that was a mistake, and we regret it.
Yes, Your Honor.
And as to the others, you said, well, no, here's the reason we did it, and it's defensible, and so on.
That's right.
So what reason is there to think that had this been, had you had the safe harbor, you would have done anything different?
Because if there had been a safe harbor with an opportunity to withdraw the pleading and then resubmit it, you know, certainly what we would have done is we would have eliminated any sort of provision or any sort of statement in there that caused the sort of controversy and tried to say, well, this is an inference rather than, you know, it apparently coming across as some sort of a, you know, perhaps a statement of fact.
And you're in a tough spot, obviously, when the judge issues a show cause order, because if you essentially confess error to all of them, you may have more of a problem on your hands. On the other hand, if you fight all of them tooth and nail, that may not look so good. It's a delicate position, I assume.
Yeah, and that's right. And so our interest is in number one, showing that there was a factual basis for the arguments that were made, but at the same time, certainly not abandoning the case in the face of a motion for summary judgment. Certainly the intent of the opposition to summary judgment was to make an argument that there were, in fact, facts to be decided at a bench trial. And there was certainly no intent to deceive or manipulate the record because the magistrate was going to try the case. And it's an age, federal age discrimination case, and there's no jury trial.
Well, this all suggests what Judge Boudin said, I think, in Young, that there should be more serious appellate review under these circumstances. We have an abuse of discretion standard. Abuse of discretion takes into consideration all the circumstances. Given that there are more difficult circumstances when it's sua sponte, there ought to be more serious a review by the appellate court. It doesn't get you to the akin to contempt, which requires adopting something in the rules that's in the notes that's not in the rules, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. And so there are, I guess, to distinguish separate arguments. One is whether or not the court ought to take a close look, a stringent, or the standard ought to be more stringent. And I think the majority rule is that where the sanctions are imposed sua sponte, that the courts of appeal take a closer look. And secondly, the whole concept from the advisory committee notes, that is the akin to contempt standard, and that also seems to be a standard that's been adopted by a number of courts. And the reason, the rationale for looking to the notes is that the courts of appeal, and especially the courts of appeal in the Second Circuit, are saying, well, we're really concerned about the chilling effect on advocacy of the sua sponte sanctions, and therefore, because the notes suggest that the sanctions ought to be reserved for really serious, really egregious cases where, you know, nothing in the pleading is meritorious, whether, for example, the pleading is frivolous, that you know, it ought to be something that's akin to contempt.
Would have been easy to put that in the rule.
It certainly would have been. But as I, you know, looking through the history of the notes, it appears that the advisory committee decided or included in the terms of the wording of the notes that the akin to contempt standard is appropriate, just because, you know, we expect that the only time that a sua sponte sanction would be imposed is that there was really a serious violation for a frivolous pleading. And, you know, that has been the approach, I think, that most of the courts have taken. And if you look at the cases where sanctions have been affirmed by the Court of Appeals, there have been cases where there's been a complete absence of any factual support for the pleading, or where the pleading has been dismissed on Rule 12b6 motion or Rule 9 motion, where there aren't specific facts to support a finding of a fraud at the end of the game or a RICO violation. And, you know, in most of the cases where there have been a finding affirmed by the courts of appeals is where the pleading at issue is totally without merit, and I would submit that's not the circumstances here. Number one, it was a winning pleading, and number two, that there's no certainly no precedent for saying that there was no factual support for, you know, for the sort of arguments that that the plaintiff was seeking to make in opposing the motion for summary judgment. And, you know, to the extent that it comes down to a question of policy, this time the sanction was imposed on a plaintiff's attorney for filing a winning pleading. Well, you know, if that's fair game, then the next sanction is going to be imposed on a government attorney for filing a motion for summary judgment that the court finds was not meritorious because there were disputes of material fact. So it's to that extent, it's perhaps a policy issue. Unless there are any questions, I'd like to reserve the balance of my time.
I'm afraid there isn't any time, but we'll give you something.
Thank you, Ron.
May it please the court. We urge that the ruling of the district court be affirmed because the district court properly exercised its discretion when it found that counsel had violated Rule 11B after he failed to either withdraw or rather provide sufficient explanations for an array of misstatements in the offending submissions or withdraw it.
You agree that if the magistrate erred as a matter of law, then he abused his discretion, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
So I want to ask this question quite seriously. I have two legal questions here, both of which you're defending in your briefs. The government understands that this rule will apply to its own AUSAs, correct?
Absolutely.
Have you ever seen in opposing summary judgment an AUSA write that this is an inference and not a fact?
The question is, have I ever seen?
Yeah, in all the oppositions to summary judgment that you've seen, I have to say I've never seen that distinction ever made in the assistant U.S. attorneys or, in fact, in a plaintiff, in opposing counsel's. The district, the magistrate in this case said, citing the Curl opinion, that when a party relies on an inference rather than fact, rather than a fact, he has to say so. Now, that is based on a extensive quotation from a 1954 New Jersey opinion.
Greensburg.
Which you know has nothing to do with Rule 11, since there was no Rule 11 at the time, right?
That's correct.
That's right. So that was actually based on New Jersey's sort of ethical rules, its code of conduct for lawyers. And similarly, even Judge Noonan's opinion was 1986. It was not before the 1993 amendments to the rules. Now, let me ask you about this specific example, which the magistrate uses, and it was really the basis for the whole opinion. He says, a classical example is a man walks into a room with a wet umbrella. This might permit the inference that the man was recently outside and then it was raining. This is not a fact. It's just an inference. The statement that it was raining was false. Now, typically when this example is taught, the difference is not between facts and inferences, but between direct and circumstantial evidence. Isn't that right?
That's my understanding.
Right. So the wet umbrella is circumstantial evidence that it's raining. It's not just an inference. It's circumstantial evidence as opposed to direct evidence where you see. But circumstantial evidence is a fact as well. And in fact, I'll read to you from the Red Book jury instruction, which is given in most cases. There are two types of evidence from which you may find the truth as to the facts of a case: direct evidence and circumstantial evidence. The law makes no distinction between these two, nor does circumstantial evidence require a greater degree of certainty than direct evidence. So when the rule says you have to have evidentiary support, you can have either circumstantial or direct. And I don't see anything in the rule that requires a party to distinguish by saying this is only circumstantial. All right, so that's a long précis to my first serious legal problem. Can you say where it is in the rules that requires the party to distinguish? And this is the basis for at least half of the more than half of the magistrate's concern here.
First of all, Your Honor, I'd like to note that the magistrate does not have a problem with parties using inferences.
No, but he requires them to say when it's an inference, and those words are not in the rule. Where does he get the idea, other than Curl, which is based on a 1954 non-Rule 11 decision?
The Rule 11b3 says that factual contentions must have evidentiary support.
Yes. And as I just read you from the Red Book instruction that's given in almost every trial in this district, a factual contention can be either based on circumstantial or direct evidence.
Yes, but there must be some evidence in the record for the contentions brought forth. And
you agree it could be circumstantial evidence?
Yes. However, to mislead the court in the way that counsel had in this particular instance, not just once, Your Honor, but 11 times over and over again, was the magistrate judge's problem.
Not to interrupt Judge Garland, other than to say the leading treatise on Rule 11 says it's not always necessary or possible to distinguish between fact and inference, however. Rule 11 is not intended to require philosophical or semantic parsing of this sort. That seems to be what was going on here.
Yes, Your Honor. It's true that can't always be done. However, one has to look at the context of the representations made by counsel in this particular case. And
I want to get to those, although Judge Garland has a second question, I think.
My second question is, on several of the problems that the magistrate judge found here, the problem that he found was that the statement of facts doesn't disclose that there are other facts. That is, that they present it as if it's he is presenting undisputed these facts as undisputed, correct?
Yes, Your Honor, there's a problem with that.
Right. I don't understand this. This is an opposition to summary judgment, correct?
Yes, it was.
So it wasn't their burden, and in fact wouldn't even have been their place, to argue that the facts were undisputed. rather to argue these are the facts on our side as opposed to the facts that the government is claiming are undisputed, right?
Yes, Your Honor, if we could refer the court to footnote 15 of our brief, we provide a lengthy explanation. It's on page 46.
I've read it, but it didn't persuade me. So I'm giving you another opportunity to persuade me.
Yes, Your Honor. Basically, if I understand Judge Facciola's decision, his problem was with the misleading nature of the representations made in counsel's statement of material facts that were disputed, and there was one or two that was that there were one or two statements that were also made in the facts that we allegedly omitted.
That's true, but he doesn't say that those are undisputed. He just says here are some facts on our side. Maybe the government will dispute. Maybe they won't. But this is a local Rule 7H response, right?
Correct, yes, sir.
And what our local rule says, or what the district court's local rule says, an opposition to such motion shall be accompanied by a separate, concise statement of genuine issues, setting forth all material facts as to which it is contended there exists a genuine issue. That means a dispute. There's actually no provision for claiming that facts are undisputed. That's what you would do if you were trying to get summary judgment, and they were not trying to get summary judgment here.
That's correct, Your Honor. What counsel did in this instance was to present the court with facts that he alleged the government omitted from its opening brief.
Right, but do you think that in an opposition to summary judgment, you have to say not only your own facts, but you also have to say, and by the way, the government's got some facts on the other side?
No, Your Honor, but what counsel did in this instance was to present to the magistrate judge facts that were allegedly omitted by us. And when an attorney represents to the court that these are facts that were omitted, he is alleging that there's evidentiary basis for them.
But there is.
But not undisputed. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Not undisputed. That's the point. I, of course, that's right. But what I'm asking is the magistrate several places says that Mr. Carl is representing that these are undisputed. And typically, where you're saying facts are in dispute, you're not claiming that they could argue that you left out facts without also saying that you have no response.
Okay, if I may take a step back.
Please.
When one says something is a fact, that means there is no dispute.
Really?
That's my understanding, Your Honor.
What does the phrase disputed fact mean?
Well, that is something that Mr. Carl failed to do here. He represented these assertions as facts without noting that there was another side to the story.
I guess it follows that a fact can't be false either.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
A fact can't be false either.
No, then it's an allegation. Then it's an assertion. Then you can't call it a fact.
That's reverse engineering. To decide that after you determine it's false, that it's not a fact. I mean, it's a false statement of fact.
No, Your Honor, the way it was presented, Mr. Carl was not bound to present these additional assertions that he made before the district court. He, under Rule 7H, he did have an obligation to let the court know what the disputed facts were, but he went a step beyond and provided these additional quote-unquote facts.
But there had evidentiary support for many of them, right? All you have to have is have evidentiary support.
No, Your Honor, he didn't have an evidentiary support for all of them. That was a problem.
For many of them, he did. For example, I think some of these examples, the fairly refused to respond and refused to turn over the notes. That's true. He refused initially to respond and refused to turn over the notes. You can quarrel.
The statement even says initially.
During the first stages of the
And you can quarrel with the word refused. The agency destroyed the documents. Well, fairly testified in his deposition that he, quote, trashed, unquote, a personnel folder. Is trashed equal destroyed? I think so. Ms. Berry also admits that she lacked a comprehensive knowledge of the library. That was the word comprehensive is a adjective to describe her testimony, and it is supported by citations to the record, her own testimony. Dr. Fairley told Ms. Berry at the interview that she had been selected. True. That's Ms. Berry said it herself. Now, she later backtracked from that, but she also said it herself at the deposition. Ms. Butler stated that the decision of the panel was not unanimous. Ms. Butler said that she didn't vote and that she would have voted for someone else, and she was on the panel, i.e., wasn't unanimous. I don't see the necessary problem there. Ms. Berry received the questions in coaching. This is based on plaintiff's own statement, own affidavit, saying he heard that said to her by one of the other people involved. And those are six or seven examples. I can go through all of them. But there is, now part of the problem here is I think they're relying on plaintiff's affidavit, right? And plaintiff's affidavit in turn is based on things that might be questioned. Right, but it might be questioned. But that said, plaintiff's affidavit is evidence, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
So plaintiff's affidavit is evidence. Relying on plaintiff's affidavit or responses to interrogatories is evidentiary support, correct?
Your Honor, if I may.
Can you just answer that? Is relying on plaintiff's affidavit or the plaintiff's response to interrogatories evidentiary support?
Self-serving affidavit, yes, Your Honor.
Is it evidentiary support?
Yes.
Okay.
If I may go back to the very first, you gave five or six examples, and I'll take a couple of them, where the problems were with these assertions made by counsel. The first assertion that you mentioned, Your Honor, was that Dr. Fairley refused to respond, and this is a direct quote, refused to respond to the interrogatories from the EEO investigator, which she had not done, and refused to turn over the notes during the first stages of the administrative process. Here's what happened, if I may take just a quick second to spell out the situation. The EEO investigator goes to Mr. Fairley and says, hand over the documents. Mr. Fairley says, fine, I'll give you the documents, with the exception of these, where there may be Privacy Act protection issues. I need to touch base with General Counsel's office.
That's a justification. Yeah. That's an explanation. But it is the case he didn't turn it over, right?
Your Honor, he turned it over the very next day.
Well, that's a very good rebuttal. That's a very good response. But it doesn't make the first statement false, that in the initial phase, he refused to turn it over.
Well, that the second half perhaps is not as clear cut. But the first half of the sentence where he says refused to respond to interrogatories, flatly wrong.
Well, don't you think the during clause applies to both halves of the statement?
I think the district court put it very nicely when
it could.
It found that these were horrible half-truths.
That's not the stuff of Rule 11 sanctions to question whether the during, the prepositional phrase at the end of the sentence applies to both parts of the compound sentence, is it?
If it's misleading the court, Your Honor, then we would argue yes.
Well, is Rule 11 about misleading the court at all?
Well,
I mean, in then-Judge Breyer's opinion for the First Circuit says that's not what Rule 11 is about. It's about something very specific. It's about providing whether or not there's evidentiary support, but it's not about whether, you know, statements are crafted and misleading. That could be a code of conduct problem, and in fact, Mr. Carl was referred to the Bar Council and found that there was no case there.
Actually, Mr. Carl, the council has not provided the letters from, they're not in the record, the exact findings of Bar Council.
In any event, that's not Rule 11. That's a different rule. That's a code of conduct adopted by the ABA and by the court, but it's not Rule 11.
The rule requires, you're right, Your Honor, the rule requires that when an attorney or a party signs a document and submits it to the court that dealing with the facts, it be based on evidence. There is some serious issues that the magistrate judge found to be problematic because either the evidence did not say what was being implied, or they just simply were not there.
It was all cited, correct? There were citations. There's documentation all over the place here, right?
The citations sometimes were lacking and sometimes were non-existent. But there are citations to some places. Now, to state that it's the magistrate judge's duty to look at each and every part of a sentence to make sure that it's supported by the evidence, again, is going to put a great burden on the court.
What is your view about, in Judge Breyer's opinion and several others, they talk about the whole document. What's the government's position as to how much of a document has to be not supported before there's a Rule 11 violation? Is it every sentence?
Your Honor, there are cases that say one misrepresentation.
What's the government's position? I just want to know for the next case when an AUSA is brought up here. Is the government's position that every sentence, that there can be a separate Rule 11 violation as to every sentence, even if, as on the whole, the document satisfies Rule 11?
One has to look at the context. If there's one sentence that is egregiously misleading or goes directly to the heart of the case, then the outcome is obvious. However, if it's a tangential ancillary situation, a statement rather, then no.
Well, this didn't go to the outcome, of course, because you lost. So whatever he said didn't go to the outcome because the judge, notwithstanding finding these violations, concluded that the government lost its motion for summary judgment.
It went to the outcome of the summary judgment.
It didn't go to the outcome of the summary judgment motion.
I'm sorry, perhaps I misunderstood the court. But what I understood the situation to be is that, as Mr. Carl has said, counsel has said, his opposition, he's calling it a winning opposition. We would argue that the complaint survived our motion for summary judgment, not because of these misleading.
Exactly right. It wasn't the misleading. In a larger sense, they weren't material to the conclusion of the summary judgment motion. Correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
So if the government's position is that even if they're not material to the outcome, there can still be Rule 11 violations, I take it.
Your Honor, material in the context of a Title VII case is a bit different in that the plaintiff will argue there's pretext and the whole set of facts have to be looked at together. So given that there were 11 misleading assertions made by counsel here, we believe that the unreasonably objective standard should be applied as stated in the Young and Jenkins cases.
What about our standard of review? I couldn't tell what the government's position was exactly. On page 5 of the brief, you say courts have found that the objective standard for Rule 11 sanctions should be imposed with particular strictness when initiated by the court. Do you agree that that's an appropriate standard?
Abuse of discretion is the court's standard of review, and even if, in this particular situation, even if the court was to view this situation with particular stringency, we submit
that... I got the even if part. I'm just trying to figure out...
Yes.
If you take out the even if, you agree that we should apply the abuse of discretion standard with particular stringency?
Yes, Your Honor, and I think counsel also conceded that.
They want us to do it.
Yes, they agree to that.
And you agree.
And we do, too.
Okay.
Yes.
Further questions?
And Cooter spells that out fairly clearly. It's not a problem. Any further questions?
Thank you, Ms.
Thank you.
Mr. Carroll, you've used all your time. Do you have an overwhelming need to rebut?
Thank you, Your Honor.
That was a question.
I'm sorry?
Do you have an overwhelming need to rebut something here? You have used all your time.
I'd like about a minute and a half, if I may.
You may.
Thank you, Your Honor. Apropos Judge Garland's comment about Judge Noonan's views, Judge Noonan wrote a later opinion. It's called Arthur Children's Trust, and it's 994 Fed Second 1390. And there he said, the issue was whether or not the synopsis of a deposition was argumentative but not false. And Judge Noonan said in that circumstance that there was not a basis for Rule 11 sanctions. Secondly, we have a situation perhaps somewhat like the Holland case that I think Judge Garland wrote, where this court reversed a finding of bad faith by the same magistrate judge, and part of the argument is in favor of, I think, reversing that particular award of attorney's fees is that, this is part of what litigation is about, and litigation is...
We're talking about two different statutes. So here you have a rule, there you had an attorney's fee statute, there you had a requirement of bad faith. I mean, I appreciate the citation to one of my cases, but it doesn't appear relevant at all.
finally, from the perspective of what happens in summary judgment, I mean, it's an argument going back and forth. One side says there are material facts that are in dispute, and the other are not in dispute, and the other side says that. It says that there are. And if you look back at the plaintiff's opposition on summary judgment, I mean, I don't think any reasonable person would find that there's a representation that anybody, the plaintiff's facts, if you like, are undisputed. But if you compare paragraph 10, they say that Ms. Berry was well qualified for the position. And our response to number 10 in turn cites our plaintiff's statement of 38 through 59, later parts of the plaintiff's opposition, and what we're trying to show is that there are those facts that are very much in dispute. We'd submit that the counsel on both sides are duty-bound to argue the evidence, and that is, in fact, what happened here. And I think, without reversing or affirming the decision, would have a chilling effect upon the advocacy, not just in this area and not just against plaintiff's counsel, but against the U.S. Attorney's Office every time they lose a motion for summary judgment.
Thank you, Mr. Carroll.
Thank you.
Thank you both. The case is submitted. The court will take a brief recess.